Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. My name is Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer of Game Wisdom. We got a great podcast for you. My guest tonight, artist for Smugby Games and Game Wisdom site designer, Kenneth Olm.
Hey there.
And our special guest this week is the creative director at Red Hook Games, who are coming off of their successful Kickstarter for The Darkest Dungeon, Chris Borassa.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi, Chris. It's going great. It's great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I guess to get things started, and I know we're a bit late, but I guess congratulations are in order. You guys successfully got the Kickstarter working, and you managed to not only get the money, but you managed to complete a lot of your stretch goals.
Yeah, it was quite a ride. It was pretty incredible experience. I think even more than the financial upside, mm-hmm. The kind of morale boost and the validation mm-hmm. from the public for the game was really, really inspiring and meant a lot.
Yeah, and we were talking about this before the cast, but as I was telling you guys, the Darkest Dungeons was pretty much the first Kickstarter that I backed for 2014, and I thought you guys did an amazing job just with the overall presentation and offering of your Kickstarter.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I underestimated it. My partner Tyler Sigmund mm-hmm. put a lot of work into it, and he was like, you know, man, it's going to take, you know, two of us basically mm-hmm. full-time for 6 weeks to do this properly. And I was like, come on, we got so much art, let's put it up on the side. And he's like, no. Turns out he was right, and it took two of us about 6 to 8 weeks full-time.
Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you a bunch of questions about the Kickstarter, but we'll be talking more about that probably in a few minutes. So I guess our first question then is, for people who may not be familiar with the Darkest Dungeon or Red Hook Games, could you tell us a little bit about the studio and what is the Darkest Dungeon?
Well, Darkest Dungeon is it's kind of a gothic roguelike role-playing game that focuses primarily on the stress of the adventuring lifestyle as opposed to sort of glorifying it. Mm-hmm. And what that translates in gameplay terms is that your parties are made up of really flawed, very human characters that react positively and negatively to everything that they see and do and encounter in the dungeon, and they have lasting emotional baggage stemming mm-hmm. from their adventures. Somebody at PAX actually called this a PTSD RPG, and I thought it's a big acronym, but not entirely inaccurate. I think that's it's pretty spot on. Mm-hmm. We're trying to basically, I don't know, just shoot the dungeon crawler from a different angle. You know, there's a lot of games that do loot and sort of, you know, celebrate the achievement of logging in and the achievement of making a new character really, really well. And we wanted to sort of try something that was really harsh and brutal and try to, I don't know, find a play space in the trauma that being an adventurer would actually cause people.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how much the challenging games are becoming more popular and accepted over the years. We saw this with like Demon's Souls, FTL, Dungeons of Dreadmoor. And it's kind of weird how roguelike genre, which has been traditionally, you know, this hardcore niche, you know, only like the most masochistic people are going to like it. And now we're seeing it sort of get more wide stream appeal.
Yeah, well, I think people, it was almost like a sitcom. Like mm-hmm. companies have really figured out, you know, especially with social games and microtransactions, how to really create nice polished products that, you know, reward you for effectively, you know, doing very, very little sometimes. And I think it's just a natural, you know, the pendulum tends mm-hmm. to swing the other direction. People who are kind of more and more interested in a more, I don't know, I hate to use the word hardcore, but yeah, you know, a little bit more of a unforgiving or challenging experience.
I like to say games that have like a little bite to them. That's my
little touch. Exactly. Yeah. People want some spicy food right now. It seems mm-hmm. like we're happy to, you know, be looking to provide that to them.
Mm-hmm. Now, was Red Hook Games basically founded off of the Darkest Dungeon, or have you guys did any other projects before that?
No, Red Hook is our first game is Darkest Dungeon. My partner Tyler Sigmund and I have known each other for, I don't know, it must be pushing 10 years now, mm-hmm. which is crazy to me. But we worked together at a couple of video game studios in Vancouver, and, you know, we're friends, and we're always sort of talking about projects we'd like to do. Mm-hmm. And he worked with Kieran Kelvin, who are our engineers at another job as well. So this is kind of our first time all together as a team under the Red Hook banner, but mm-hmm. not our first sort of rodeo, I guess.
Awesome. And I forgot to mention this at the start, but not only are you the creative director, but you're also the artist for the Darkest Dungeon, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Awesome. There's a lot of art, and there's one of me.
And I know Ken has an appeal for it as well, and he's going to have a lot of questions for you later on in the cast. Because we both really enjoyed the art for the game. I think we both sort of have that same appeal to like that hand-drawn look and feel. And the Darkest Dungeon really pulls off that look really well. What do you think, Ken?
If you're the only artist, that's super impressive. But it kind of reminds me of what was the card game that was online, the CCG game? With like, that's like Dungeons and Dragons like Card Hunter?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was also a singular artist too. That was super impressive that both of you guys could do
well,
this.
I mean, Transistor and Bastion are, are one artist too, which, I mean, she blows my mind.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
I thought it was more than one artist. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they might have supporting people on the team, but it's one woman just cranks it out.
Wow. That is impressive.
Yeah.
I, on the other hand, have no artistic talent whatsoever. So whenever I see a game that's like good art, it just blows my mind like that.
What I'm always what I'm looking for in a Kickstarter too is just a really set style, something that sticks with me when I look at it. I think Darkened Dungeons is definitely one that impressed me.
Like a basically a very strong visual aesthetic, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because that'll last
for quite a while, and I think that's part of the reason behind the art style is, quite honestly, I wanted something that, you know, was a little bit loose so that I could not spend as much time polishing each asset and more just focus on content, because quantity is a big part of an RPG's, you know, lifespan. You know, you want to have a lot of different places to explore and a lot of different things to find. And so the art style was actually motivated a little bit selfishly by trying to find something that I could jam out fairly quickly, although it's still taking me longer than I thought it would, naturally.
Now, the more gothic art style for The Darkest Dungeon, was that something that you had the idea for right at the beginning when developing the game? Or did you go through like other different art styles as you were coming up with the initial concept?
Well, no. I mean, I knew that we wanted it to look gritty, and not in the normal map, you know, kind of realistic sense of the word, but worn and old. And we wanted it to feel like it was from the time that it's describing. So like a little bit like an illuminated manuscript, that kind of thing. But the proportions of the characters were something that changed a lot. Initially, they had a lot more of that social game kind of cuteness going on. And so I had to wrestle with that a little bit, because, you know, the first pass had the heavy black shadows, was fairly Croquilly, I guess. But it certainly didn't have, like, they didn't look cool enough. They looked too cute, which, so we kind of balanced that back and forth. Because I want them to have a little bit of that sort of a gentle cuteness, I guess, just a dash of it, just to sort of, like, contrast all the horrible stuff that's going to happen to these characters. And to remind players that it's an experience worth enjoying, not something that,
not
it,
like,
you know, is
two souls crushingly depressing.
Right, yeah. But, you know, they still have to look kind of cool, and I need a little bit of latitude. So if everything is super cutesy, then there's no way to, to go.
So what made the design too cutesy, you would say?
Well, their heads, they were closer to three heads tall. Which, you know, can be a bit of a problem. You know, they had like way bigger hands. I just kind of played to the sort of traditional, I don't know, the Mickey Mouse kind of proportions at first, because I thought they would read better. But ultimately, we settled on this kind of weird, like, four heads high kind of thing, which is kind of unconventional, at least artistically speaking, I think. But it works well. They kind of look like little cool, like, desk toys or vinyl toys kind of thing. So I'm happy with where we ended up.
Well, yeah, and because it is a bit strange, it also very unique. That's what stood out to me when I look at the character designs.
Cool, yeah. I mean, we want to avoid some of the sort of, let me be clear, I love Diablo, and I played my fair share of MMOs and all that stuff, but we wanted to just try something a little bit different than the giant shoulder pads and that kind of thing.
Now, with a lot of, like, the more, I guess, unique character design, stuff like the Plague Doctor, the Leper, the Jester, or, like, these characters who have, like, a very, like, unique look and feel to them, how did you go about, I guess, differentiating the different class designs from each other while still keeping things to, like, the same, like, gothic theme?
Well, we knew we wanted to try, like, we were taking this sort of fundamentally different take on a dungeon game. And so to really reinforce that idea and to make it feel like when you boot up the game for the first time that you're not able to take the same things for granted that you ordinarily would when you load up a new dungeon crawler, we wanted that to immediately hit you in the face. So the first thing that you see when you start a game is like, okay, well, what classes do I have? So it made a lot of sense for us to sort of sidestep the traditional, like, wizard, rogue, those archetypes. I mean, they're great, but they also have a lot to say. So for instance, like, you know, if you look at a rogue, if you're not doing double damage as a backstab and you're not turning invisible, you feel pretty ripped off if it's a rogue. So for us, you know, we call him a highwayman, and now you're not sure if he can turn invisible. That's not sort of engendered in the name of the class anymore. So it helps us to sort of shake people's expectations a little loose when they start the game. So that was the philosophical decision behind doing it. Also because it's fucking cool. We wanted to try and get something a little bit more grounded and just left to center and have some fun in the non-D&D space, like no elemental magic, no sort of lightning bolt stuff, that kind of thing.
You know, in a way, too, giving those different names like that, like Highwayman, it grounds it a little bit more away from the magical. Yeah, so that's good.
Yeah. And when I was looking at the Darkest Dungeon, how you guys had like that very varied class design, it reminded me of one of my other favorite games, the Etrian Odyssey series on the 3DS and DS. Have you heard of those?
No, I haven't.
They're basically like, they were developed, I think, a few years ago from Atlas, and they're sort of like a Japanese take on like the Western PC dungeon crawler design. So it has like a lot more of, like, it has like an anime-ish look and feel to it, but it also has like a very brutal dungeon crawler. So you create a party of five guys, and it's basically a game where, you know, your party dies, it's game over. You have to go back to a save point. And they also did very interesting things with the class design. Like, they spread out their skills so you didn't have to fall into, like, the same fantasy trifecta of mage, healer, warrior. And as you were just talking about with Darkest Dungeon, with trying to ground these classes in this reality while still keeping them varied, that was another thing that really caught my eye when I was looking at the Kickstarter.
Cool. Well, then it worked. That's great. Yeah. It's also a lot of fun to sort of challenge yourself, like, you know, from a creative standpoint, just, okay, if you think you can do it better, then let's see. Like, what ideas do you actually have in the back of your head? So it's been a lot of fun to challenge ourselves to come up with, you know, different takes on the sort of classic archetypes. The four characters that we had at PAX were the Highwayman, the Vestal, the Crusader, and the Plague Doctor. And they kind of represent, like, they're our sort of most archetypal characters, maybe with the exception of the Plague Doctor. But, you know, you still need a knight. You know, you still need a battle healer. But, you know, now that those are out of the way, we're sort of moved into production on our next four, which are like, you know, the Bounty Hunter and the Occultist and that kind of stuff. So it's been a lot of fun.
Cool. Now, one thing that you were talking about a few minutes ago, that the Darkest Dungeon was sort of you and Tyler's like pet project, an idea that you really wanted to do. When you guys first started Red Hook, were there any other projects floating around your heads, or was the Darkest Dungeon pretty much cemented as, we want to make this as our first project?
Yeah, we built the company to make this game.
Cool.
Because, I mean, the game really, I like to draw this way. It's not my natural kind of style, but I really enjoy it. And Tyler is a systems designer, and so the project was really just built based on our sort of core strengths. You know, I had some ideas like, oh, positional combat, there, we'll shoot it from the side, it'll be really fun. I don't know what to do with it after that. But Tyler's, they got an incredible grasp of Excel and general board game design, and so he can kind of pick the ball up and really run with it and pay that out in terms of, you know, real fun. Whereas I can just talk a mean streak about how awesome it's gonna be.
Great. So I think with that, let's get into talking about the actual Kickstarter. So, I guess the first question that I have, and I guess we actually sort of answered this already, is the fact that Darkest Dungeon was pretty much developed pretty much with the creation of Red Hook. So, did Kickstarter itself or the general rise of crowdfunding had any impact on you guys developing the Darkest Dungeon? Or were you guys pretty much dead set on making the Darkest Dungeon with or without the advantage of crowdfunding at the time?
Mostly the latter, but we weren't ignorant to the sort of rise of crowdfunding. I mean, we wanted to make the game. We sat down and inspected out. But we knew that Kickstarter is the best source of money for a startup, quite frankly, because you don't get people in for equity. You know, there's it's the simplest, easiest way to sort of help support your project. So after we decided we were going to do the game, come hell or high water, no matter what, the next decision or the next sort of obvious thing was, okay, and now we also must kickstart it. So they were, you know, yeah, we decided to do the game no matter what, but the first thing we also, you know, decided after that was that, yeah, we had to start planning for a Kickstarter.
Cool. Now, how long were you guys working on the Darkest Dungeon before you went to Kickstarter itself?
Quite a while, about 9 months.
Okay.
We didn't want to show up cold on the internet and ask people for money. We wanted to demonstrate in real terms to potential backers and people who are interested in the game that, you know, we'd already sunk in a fair amount of time, that, you know, we weren't drawing any kind of paycheck. That was our level of commitment to the game and to the project. Rather than just quickly throw up a Kickstarter page with some nice art and cross our fingers, we wanted to have some momentum and say, you know, hop on this moving train. We'd love to have you, as opposed to, you know, help us get this thing started. So I guess philosophically, that's where we were coming from. And also, I just feel like it's weird to ask people for their support and their cash. If you don't have anything invested yourself, you know, like if you've got a full-time job and you do a Kickstarter on the side and you're like, well, if it works out, great. You know, there's nothing really wrong with it, but for us, this was an all-in move.
Okay.
We both play poker together and it's kind of like, this is it. So.
Now, how did you guys decide on pretty much the point that you went to Kickstarter, or how far into Darkest Dungeon did you guys say, okay, we have this and this done. Is it ready for Kickstarter? Yes. Okay. Let's go and set this thing up.
It was a timing decision. Mm-hmm. So we created the first trailer as we were getting our engine up and running. And that was meant to sort of stress test the mechanics and the overall presentation and tone and vibe, and then see if there was an audience for it. And we released that in October, last October. And we timed that so that it was after PAX, but before the big console announcements. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we'd have a little bit of there'd be a dead spot and we could kind of get some eyes on us. That seemed to work pretty well. And then we started collecting emails for our mailing list, knowing that we're going to keep talking to these people and sort of hype them up as much as we could leading into our eventual Kickstarter launch. The Kickstarter launch was also a timing decision. We didn't want to do it in December. Everybody's spending money on Titanfall and new consoles, or, you know, and they're, you know, spending money on gifts and they don't have money for Kickstarter. It's such a luxury to be able to be out on the internet sort of sponsoring these projects. So we wanted to wait until February when, you know, no, you're actually not going to go to the gym as much as you thought. All the New Year's resolutions are gone. Life is back to normal. You've had a couple of paychecks under your belt. So we thought, you know, February, middle of February would be a good time to sort of bring something fresh. And there are no big game releases around that time either. So when we knew what our timing window was, we sort of just time boxed it and worked backwards in terms of like, okay, well, what do we need to launch on February 10th or whatever it is?
Now, as you just said, instead of having like a traditional Kickstarter video, you guys put up like your trailer or your proof of concept as your official Kickstarter video, which I thought was fairly interesting from a strategy perspective, because as we see a lot of Kickstarter projects or just general crowdfunding, most of the videos are pretty much, you know, a pitch from the owners, you know, we want to make so-and-so, we're very passionate, buy our thing, and so on.
Yeah.
So what was the strategy behind using your proof of concept video as your Kickstarter video?
Well, nothing describes the game better than Wayne June's voice and Stuart Chatwood's music and the art. I think it can be endearing to shoot yourself in front of your computer and talking about, you know, sort of why you really passionately want to make the game. But I kind of felt like we wanted to sort of show up and look like we had enough steam and momentum and determination to see this thing through. And I didn't feel like a personal appeal really reflected that accurately. I think it was cooler to sort of show up with a fresh new trailer and just a ton of stuff and demonstrate concisely and clearly how well thought through the game was and how far along we were in making it.
Yep, and I think you guys did a really well done job with that. The video, it's only like 2 minutes long, but it pretty much nails just exactly what the Darkest Dungeon is, the style, the music, and you pretty much did all without, you know, having 5 minutes of someone saying, okay, so this is a dungeon crawler, this is where people go nuts, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, it's about building excitement and interest, and I think sometimes a few questions are good. And over the course of the campaign, you know, we gathered a fair number of backers, and we were able to interact with them on Twitch streams and in the comment section of the Kickstarter. And we could sort of noodle on some of the questions and get into some of the more, you know, granular aspects of the game. But, you know, as a slap in the face, I think it's good to sort of be leaving people reeling a little bit. And so they're asking themselves as they scroll down the page, you know, what is this? I've been to a lot of Kickstarter sites where I'm playing the video and the guys are talking to me and I'm kind of half-heartedly scrolling down the page, and it's just, it's not as exciting. It can drag on, I guess, if left unchecked.
Yeah, we see that with, I think, some Kickstarter videos when they hit like 10, 15 minute long pitches, you get, your eyes start to glaze over. I know I've done that a few times. It's just, okay, let me just fast forward through them talking. Let me see the gameplay. Oh, they're talking more. Let me fast forward through that. And it does become hard to keep that momentum when you start getting to those really long videos.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And really, our trailers are meant to be like, hey, do you like this art?
Mm-hmm.
Do you like the way this music sounds? Do you like this creepy voiceover?
Mm-hmm.
Do you like dungeon games? If so, read some more. Because it's all written down there, and we proofread it, and it's better than me just kind of winging it on a video. So yeah, that was the idea anyway.
I was going to say the material, too, that you placed on there, that was pretty good in terms of like having a theme, because if you were to put yourself in the video itself, it would kind of, I've said it before, take you out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really
do
like
your immersion for sure.
And your animated GIFs, I think, are good enough. I think they're what actually mesmerizes me as I scroll down the page.
I have to say, that was all Tyler. Mm-hmm. He came into the office one day. He's like, "We need animated GIFs, animated GIFs." He was just so hot about them. I was like, "Man, okay, sure." And we've gotten so much praise for the animated GIFs. So.
Well, they're so smooth too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're pretty big.
I stared at one for the last like 10 minutes. I guess,
yeah, it's so memorizing watching them. It's like it's only like the same 2-3 seconds of footage, but it just looks so like well, and like as we talk about that, ourselves so eye catching that it just really gives the game a really unique look and flavor.
Yeah, we've definitely gotten a lot of positive feedback about the art and the style overall, and it's humbling, and I'm really happy that people are excited about it. It's cool.
And going back to the video for one quick second, as I was telling you guys before the cast, pretty much like as you said, having like that 2-minute just perfect encapsulation of the design really was a strong effort. And as I was saying, my friends basically were telling me, okay, here's a video. Don't look at this if you don't have money to spend. Like, I can resist this pretty well.
Perfect.
And I watch, I'm like, damn it, where's my credit card?
Well, I appreciate that. The trailer we used as our landing trailer for Kickstarter was the one that we released in October.
Mm-hmm.
But we also did like a new one fresh just for Kickstarter. But it was like an Empire Strikes Back to the Star Wars version of the first one. It's a little darker, maybe. Mm-hmm. If you already like the first one, then the second one has a lot of value, but it doesn't do as clear a job of explaining the sort of ground rules of the game. And that's why we stuck with the original trailer as the Kickstarter landing one, because it's perfect for sort of a quick read on what you can expect. And if you're interested, then the second trailer you should like that one.
And you're referring to that's the House of Ruin trailer on the Kickstarter page?
Yeah, that's okay. the sort of follow-up one that we did for our Kickstarter, just to sort of have something fresh for people.
Cool. Now, another aspect of the Darkest Dungeon Kickstarter is, of course, the rewards. And we've seen people talk all about different strategies and different philosophies for their reward structure. So for you guys, how did you come up with the rewards that you're going to give to your backers?
It's a really, really critical part of the process, because really this is what you're hoping people are interested enough in to purchase. So we took quite a while. I think there was 3 or 4 different significant revisions. There's always edits as you go along, but we overhauled them, 3 or 4 big times to try and find a nice balance. At one point, we cut all the upper tier prices in half, and big surgery to just try and find something that, escalated nicely in terms of price point, but also in terms of value. We didn't want to do anything cheesy, and we also didn't want to get bogged down in physical goods. That was another big consideration. I think a lot of times, I don't even want to say a lot of times, I've seen some campaigns that I'm not sure how much money they actually net at the end of it, because they're so reliant on physical goods, and you got to fulfill all that stuff. So it's great you made 150 grand, but you've actually promised, $75,000 in miniatures and books and t-shirts and, DVD boxes. That stuff adds up. And one of the biggest heartbreaking things for us is we wanted to put it in an old school, like Eye of the Beholder box. That was our, we're both really, really passionate about that. But the economics didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Like we'd end up spending so much extra money just doing that the reward tier wouldn't even be worth it at the point. So, yeah, that was hard, but So ultimately, we tried to skew more towards digital, and you know, maybe we'll offer those things later, mm-hmm. you know, as a direct sale or something.
Yeah, and speaking about miniatures, that's one of the things that I've seen like a lot of like board games and like miniature design projects that really succeed, and they have like boxes and boxes of, you know, all these little figurines and board design. And as you were saying, I can't understand how much it could possibly cost not only to make all those, but then to, you know, send to all the people who backed and pledged to it. Just seems like an insane amount of money.
Yeah, it can add up for sure. Yeah, especially if that's not your business. Like a lot of these miniature companies, that's what they do. They have the industry. You know, their valuations of how much things are going to cost are probably fairly accurate. But I don't know anything about making toys. I know about making video games.
Okay. Now, speaking about coming up with the pricing structure, one quick question about that. I was just wondering, how did you guys come up with the pricing for your two biggest rewards, the $2,500 design a monster and the $5,000 design and character class? Was there like an actual like pricing strategy you came up with for, you know, how much it would be willing, how much it would basically cost to design something new?
Yeah, I mean, we don't, if let's say for instance we didn't fulfill that character mm-hmm. class tier, we wouldn't add the character class.
Mm-hmm.
And a character class is the most amount of work that we have in the game. It's mm-hmm. it's more than a boss. It's more than you know, even a dungeon tile set, because that is just pure art. So that requires mm-hmm. Tyler's time. It requires my time. It requires back and forth with the backer, you know, probably some failed attempts along the way. So we just need to make sure that we don't, you know, sign ourselves up for more work than we would have done ordinarily and actually end up mm-hmm. subsidizing the reward tier, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that was the big, you know, kind of metric of sort of how much does it make sense to do this for.
Now, one part that I know was like a little speed bump in the road was the reward that was going to offer Kickstarter backers an exclusive character class. I know that some people were getting a little heated about that, you know, holding a class out. And just as you were just saying, how much work there is designing a class and fitting that into the design. And I'm not sure if you guys talked about this yet or updated, but what did you guys end up doing in terms of the Kickstarter exclusive class?
Well, our response is formulated in backer update number 3.
Mm-hmm.
that's pretty much our last word on it. I thought it would just be cool,
mm-hmm.
And I didn't really. I underestimated the mm-hmm. or we underestimated the sort of response or the emotional vein that. Mm-hmm. that type of reward can tap into. It certainly wasn't, you know, our intent to take advantage of anyone or to create something that is reminiscent of a pay to win or, mm-hmm. you know, anything like that at all. So those comments actually caught me by surprise.
Mm-hmm.
I won't ever do that again. I think that was one of the big learnings for us coming out of it. We'd find some other way of rewarding tiers at that level, mm-hmm. You know, for their contribution that isn't like that.
Okay.
However, we were 3 or 4 days in, and we were getting some flack for it. We were also getting some emails from people who had backed at that level saying, listen, I backed at this level to get this reward, you know, mm-hmm. please don't change it kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we debated it fiercely for about a day and a half, like all mm-hmm. of us in a room, like arguing with each other, you know,
mm-hmm.
and switching positions and trying to stress test different,
mm-hmm.
different solutions, looking at other campaigns who had kind of gotten themselves in the same position and evaluating, you know, their solutions. And ultimately we landed on the fact that we had sold $49 tiers to hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm.
And by changing anything about that reward
mm-hmm.
would be, you know, a little disingenuous. Even if 99% of them were okay with it, if 1% wasn't, we're changing the terms of a contract we've entered into without really asking their permission.
Mm-hmm.
And they bought a basket of goods, and now we're telling them that something's different in the basket.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't get right with that. So mm-hmm. our response was just, look, it wasn't our intention, and
mm-hmm.
We're not changing anything because we've essentially entered into what we feel is like an ethical contract with all our backers at every level.
Mm-hmm.
So the minute we start noodling around with the tiers, I just feel like it undermines the entire offering. So
okay, yeah, Ben, as you say, it can be a bit crazy what some people will latch onto. We've seen this with like other Kickstarters. You know, I remember there was a whole thing with the Goddess Kickstarter when they were talking about if it's going to be on mobile or PC. And it's very quickly to get those fires started, and it can be sometimes difficult to put them out before, you know, things blow up in your face.
Yeah, I think people are passionate about games, and I think that's great. I think that's, you know, you see a lot of this kind of stuff in MMO forums. People get really, really fired up about, you know, issues that you could argue are inconsequential, or you could argue they're super important. What I see is that people care so much about it that they're willing to take their emotional energy and their time to post comments. So I value even the critiques, because to me that's coming from a place of interest and passion, and, you know, occasionally frustration. But so I think the whole process is healthy. It can be really draining though, especially on the receiving end sometimes.
And I guess one other question regarding the class then. Have you guys thought about having it like available like later on as DLC, or having people able to pledge more to get it, or something like that?
We've thought a lot of different things. We're not really ready to come out one way or the other about it. I think at this point we're just gonna let sleeping dogs lie and fulfill the game and make a great game and see where that leaves us. You know, we've also had questions about, you know, well, do you have other dungeons planned as DLCs? And, you know, that kind of even just falls in the same category. It's like, look, we have a ton of work ahead of us, and we don't have a long-term strategy for like post-release content. We've got a wall of half nonsensical ideas that we'd love to get to at some point. But our entire focus right now is on making a great game and something that people feel great about backing.
Yeah, you can save that stuff for, you know, down the pipeline, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of like, you know, what are you going to be doing next year? I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, hopefully we're doing DLC for Darkest Dungeon. That'd be a dream come true. What that DLC is, I have no idea.
All right. And I have just one set of questions left about the Kickstarter, and then we'll move on. And that is regarding your stretch goals. And stretch goals are another major component behind Kickstarters. And with the list for the Darkest Dungeon, you got pretty important or pretty sizable content that was available. You got a new class, there was having random variants of boss design, even, you know, designing the town, adding more stuff for that. So how did you guys decide or basically pick what order or what things you were going to put for the stretch goals, and what was going to basically stay in the core game, or what people would get if the game got just the basic funding?
Well, we tried to add fun, quite honestly. We tried to add, you know, content like the floating enemies, like the brigands, that adds, you know, value to everybody's game. So, I mean, we wanted to pick rewards that would enhance everybody's experience, even the $15 tiers, you know. So, you know, with that in mind, things like additional bosses for more replayability, like I said, kind of roaming enemies that maybe have a few special things about them, like the brigands. We tried to start out, you know, additional character classes was a big one, you know, because we just figured, hey, if people are interested in the game, then they'd definitely be interested in more characters, because that's kind of the heart and soul of what makes the game tick. And so we tried to stagger them out with some of these, I could use air quotes, like smaller kind of rewards.
Yeah.
And then build up to something bigger. Like one of the biggest rewards that we were offering was like a new dungeon. And a new dungeon for us is, you know, custom new set of enemies, new set of interactive objects. Like, you know, our dungeons are almost like little D&D modules. So that was a big reward for us to add in there. But we felt like we could amortize the cost across the previous rewards and make it work. So, and it was also, you know, a lot of our stretch goals were just driven by things that we wanted to do, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm really happy where we ended up. Like, it would have been great to get the cinematics in there, but that might have even adversely affected our production schedule, just because there is only, you know, the one artist. So, I'm happy with where the game proper ended up. You know, we've got a lot of great content, a couple bosses for each zone, you know, like extra enemies. We managed to get the Cove dungeon in, which is our straight up nod to Lovecraft, which I think is going to be really great and fun to work on. So I'm happy. I feel like we're delivering, you know, the absolute best core game experience we possibly can.
Now, another thing with the stretch goals, I think you guys, during the campaign, you moved some stretch goals around. I know you sort of combined two or three of them to create the 350,000 mega goal. I guess, what was the strategy or rationale behind moving the goals around during mid-campaign, basically?
Well, that actually was quite late in the campaign. And we were trending pretty well on KickTrack, and we figured, you know, if we can actually get to 350K, you know, we want to do Steam Workshop support, you know, at some point. So we figured, you know, because cinematics uses art and Steam Workshop integration uses engineering, and as kind of like a real big thank you to everyone, we could probably eat some of the cost ourselves and just roll those into the same thing and, you know, maybe, you know, generate a little bit of hype and make the end of the campaign, you know, exciting for people. So, you know, we didn't quite get there, but, you know, I still think it was a cool thing to do.
Awesome. And here's one question. I'm not sure if you're going to be able to answer this or not, but what was the 500,000 mystery goal? I see that at the bottom of the list. And I've just been curious about what you guys had planned if you were able
it's
to hit that.
It's a mystery. It's a mystery.
The DLC.
The truth is, we had a couple of pretty crazy ideas, but we weren't going to decide until we got there.
Okay.
So it was like it was going to be. We had a short list, but it was, you know, kind of. Could have gone a number of different ways, and I don't even want to say what they are, not because I have some ridiculous sense of secrecy. It's just because I don't. We might do them, and I want to keep that surprise for when it'll, you know, mean something. I also don't want to, like, you know, be feeling like, oh damn, you know. but yeah, so we had a couple ideas, but we just called it a mystery goal because we just didn't want to spend another, you know, day and a half or something running numbers and debating whether or not it was worth it to do. We're like, okay, well, if things are going that well, then we can figure it out then.
Okay. And here's my last question regarding the Kickstarter then. And this is one that I like to ask all of our guests who've had successful Kickstarters. And that is regarding the future of Kickstarter and crowdfunding. We've been seeing articles and people talking about this for like the last year, maybe a little bit more than that, regarding the state of Kickstarter and crowdfunding and if they feel that it can be a sustainable model for developers in the future. So I was just wondering, in your opinion, do you feel that this crowdfunding trend that has helped you with The Darkest Dungeon, do you think that is something that can remain sustainable for years to come? Or do you think there may be some hiccups or something that may be happening down the line that may upset this?
Well, I can only speak for myself and not, you know, the other guys on the team or anything. Everything changes. Everything shifts. I think Kickstarter's in its, you know, golden years for sure. So it might not remain the way it is. But even now, even when we kickstarted, we were a little bit late to the party. Yeah. Like the real heyday of Kickstarter was about a year before we even launched, where it was just like put anything up, and you know, you're kind of gold. So I think the standards are going to rise for projects that get supported. I think people are going to become more discerning and maybe a little bit less speculative. But I think as a model, I have nothing but good things to say about it. It allows, you know, for really ingenious and interesting projects to get funded, like things like Hyperlight and, you know, Banner Saga. And there's so many great, great Kickstarter games. I think the biggest risk that Kickstarter has is these games coming out and being lackluster. And people say, okay, well, you know what, enough of that. But that wouldn't even be Kickstarter's fault or the model's fault. I think it's really on the developers. So if we can keep, you know, creating great content for people based off of Kickstarter campaigns, I don't see any reason why, you know, the whole paradigm would suddenly vanish. I do think it'll, you know, it'll change over time. And
I think it's
great because it allows the creative freedom. That's the biggest thing for me.
Definitely.
As kind of one of the, you know, creators, it's so liberating to work on something that I'm passionate about and that I can make decisions on, that I don't have to, you know, worry about publisher feedback or, you know, because they can be quite risk averse. And so you get a lot more, I don't know, risky and kind of adventurous projects.
Definitely. All right. So I guess with that, Ken, do you have any Kickstarter-related questions for Chris?
No, I think that you went over the list of questions pretty well.
Okay. And one more that I just thought of. Do you have any suggestions, like, for people who are listening to this who are either doing their own crowdfunding projects or doing them right now, do you have any suggestions or things you guys learned regarding crowdfunding projects that you could share with them?
Sure. I mean, there's no real magic bullet. We got a lot of people asking us, you know, for feedback and advice and stuff. And I don't think that there's any one thing that always works for every project. I think the kind of cool thing about Kickstarter is that your strategy is has got to be just as tailored to you and your project as your project is, you know?
Yeah.
The things we learned, though, I'd be careful of backer exclusive content. I would take the time to build an audience before you arrive at Kickstarter. Like, don't make Kickstarter your announcement party. Because you know, you're showing up and no one knows who you are, and then you're also asking for money. I would try to, you know, get some development time in, get a really fleshed out idea of what it is that you're looking for, essentially investment on, and build a fan base, or at least you know, work to create some level of interest out there before you bring it to Kickstarter. I think that was something that really helped as well. And I don't know, having a really clear vision that you can articulate clearly never hurts.
Awesome.
I've been seeing a lot of people like discussing that they're going to launch a Kickstarter, or just making people aware when they talk about projects. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, definitely helps. And the whole audience thing is definitely a great idea, because there's so many Kickstarter projects that fail. This, you know, because they have, what you said, there's no audience. But I think the only way people get around that is if they have a famous person attached to the project.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, but that's even a new thing. Like, Kickstarter kind of, you know, in its early days, it was for the nobodies, right? Like guys like us, where, you know, we don't have a celebrity on our team. But now, you know, because it's so effective, you know, there's celebrity projects out there that are attracting attention by name recognition, and that's a development that wasn't there a year ago. You know, that's a change that the model is kind of going through.
Yeah, I usually say there's three factors that goes into it. Either you have someone famous, you have an old IP, or you put the word zombie in it, and usually you're pretty successful.
Yeah, yeah. I can't argue with the zombie thing. There's definitely a lot of zombie stuff out there.
Yep.
So, and this is another random question. I'd actually never thought about it, but did you ever look at Indiegogo as another alternative if everything went sour with Kickstarter?
Yeah, it was on the table. We just didn't, you know, we wanted to do one thing at a time. Like, prepping a campaign, we took it, you know, as seriously as we possibly could. Mm-hmm. So we didn't want to have two rough campaigns ready to go, or half plan the Kickstarter, because we were busy also trying to figure out what we would do for Indiegogo. So we sunk everything we had into the Kickstarter, and then if it didn't work out, then yeah, we would start exploring, you know, other crowdfunding options.
Yeah, I always feel that there's less buzz for Indiegogo, but I believe even if your campaign fails, you keep the money though, right?
Yeah, with Indiegogo.
Yeah, you don't. It's not as gamey as Kickstarter is.
Yeah, there's a lot more film projects than that one.
Yeah, the other thing too about Kickstarter is you're backing not just for the project. This is a subjective thing, it's just my opinion, but you're also backing for the 30-day or whatever it is, the experience of being part of that project. And so I think if you can make your campaign fun and interesting and fresh and you know, involve yourself in it. Like, we spent hours in the comments stuff, and you know, the reason we did those Twitch streams was just to be able to get a chance to more intimately talk to our backers and, you know, field questions about the game. I think the more you turn the campaign itself into entertainment, the more exciting and kind of the more word of mouth might spread about what you're doing.
Yeah, I definitely feel that, because whenever it gets in the last 10 days, there's a sense of urgency and there's lots of posts going on, and you want
and
to have
backers
the
are telling
possible,
their friends, and they're tweeting it and they're putting it on their Facebooks. Like, it was really incredible the amount of support that we got in that regard. It kind of blew my mind. Like, people are like, okay, well, I've hit up my uncle for the third time, and he says tonight he'll definitely back. I'm like, geez, really? Like, don't jeopardize your relationship with your family for my video game, but kind of do, you know?
Right. Well, you know, everyone has their thing too. Like, you know, the game Abduction, the Kickstarter project. Scion. They were making myths in all those games, and then they ended up doing like casual puzzle games, and then they started to get back into the fold with like a really interesting concept called Abduction, and it's based around the same concepts as Myst and Riven in all those games. So,
cool.
And that's there it is. There we go. We have an old IP and a famous person attached to it. So that definitely was successful.
Slam dunk. Yeah.
But at that point, they almost got Oculus Rift support, but they were only like, I don't know, like 10,000 away. So I started hitting up everyone I could, everyone in the Oculus community to pull forward. So it was totally, I totally feel that. And I think that the Kickstarter stretch goals also helped with that urgency too.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. With that, let's move on to our next session then. So I'm going to tag Ken in. So Ken, if you have any questions for Chris regarding the art style for The Darkest Dungeon, feel free.
I was going to say, yeah, I mean, so the forehead's tall. It's definitely, to me, a pretty unique idea. And I always thought, when I see characters that size, I always think of it as more of towards like mobile and tablets.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can obviously, because if your character's too tall, obviously there will be, especially with the way you set the game up. Did you think about ever bringing your games to those platforms?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely want to. Not only do I think the game would be great, but I want to be on the bus and have someone like freak out when they lose their favorite character. I want to watch that. I want to be part of that that moment. But yeah, I think the art style works for it. It's definitely something that I had in the back of my head. However, we really felt it was important to be a PC RPG first. I think we're trying to create something in the vein of the classic CRPGs that we kind of grew up with because we're old. I think that, you know, coming out, debuting on iOS, for instance, not that there's anything inherently wrong with it, but it says something to the consumer about your game. So I want to be a serious like PC RPG, and then we'll port to mobile, the same way sort of XCOM did. But it's not something that we wanted to launch on.
I think you're right, because when you talk about mobile games, iOS, there's a stigma to it, right?
Yep.
That casual stigma. Ew. I mean, it's unwarranted.
Right or wrong, it's there. You know?
It's unwarranted, but your theme for your Kickstarter was like hardcore experience. So
yep.
You don't want to like sell your back your short, at least in that regards. Though, obviously, it would definitely work on a mobile device, too.
But the other thing, too, is that I don't want any ambiguity around whether or not we are free to play or with microtransactions or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I don't want that question ever to come up. And I think when you go mobile, it's a valid question. Like, mm-hmm. is it freemium? Is it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we can make the game that we want to make. We can't make a hard game that punishes you for being greedy and kind of taxes you and mm-hmm. you're going to lose guys and get frustrated. We can't make that game and then also have microtransactions because it will be seen as just paywalls.
Yeah.
You know, this got to be a single purchase. You get the whole thing, go in and have some fun.
Yeah, and as a quick aside, I was reading more about the Goddess game last night, and they're having that sort of debate with the game. It's going to be on both mobile and PC. And as you said, they're trying to decide, you know, what's going to be free, what's going to be pay, and people are just generally confused about, okay, if I buy the mobile version, what am I getting versus the PC version? And it's just really just unnecessary fluff when you're trying to develop a game, really.
And you know what? If the game is good, there'll be a demand for it, mm-hmm. and you'll figure out how to bring it to tablet. But I don't want to figure out how to bring the game to tablet before mm-hmm. I make a great game.
Yeah.
Quite honestly, you know, like mm-hmm. if I can't make it fun on a keyboard and mouse, then you know,
mm-hmm.
I got bigger problems.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think we have discussion a lot because there is such a bad stigma for mobile and free to play, and you know, a lot of developers that go for both platforms, and they always have to kind of like fight that hurdle, you know, because of all those really exploitive games that exist, it really hurts those platforms from moving forward past it or evolving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And not every developer approaches mobile from, you know, from that place, but there are a lot that have. And so, you know, I think people are maybe a little reticent sometimes when they hear free to play or, you know, microtransactions, even though I've played games where I felt like the microtransactions were done completely responsibly mm-hmm. and I had no problem, you know, throwing $20, you know, in gold or whatever it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just not the model that works for our game. Our game yeah. is, you buy it, you get the works, and, you know, you can stream it, you can do whatever the hell you want to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And just as long as you let us know.
So another question about the art stuff. For your Kickstarter, you had a diorama as one of the rewards. Who came up with that
yeah.
idea?
I can't remember, actually. I think, I don't know.
That was the first thing that actually caught my eye when I looked at the rewards. I'm like, what? A diorama? This looks
awesome.
We
were trying to think of, like, I don't remember who it was, but I remember generally the conversation was like, look, we want to do something that people could put on their desks, because
mm-hmm.
I love having crap all around my desk.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't want to do figurines because it's too much overhead, and then we got to get them 3D sculpted, and we need to make a game and not, you know, get in the figurine mm-hmm. business. So we're like, okay, well, yeah, what if we took the art and actually just printed it out on a really nice cardstock and had some nice little plastic stands, and then you could just basically set up the exact game, you know, on your desk. And I know that Tyler loves it because he's a big board game guy, and that gets us one step closer to a board game.
Mm-hmm.
And I like it because it's just kind of a cool thing to have out there.
Yeah, you can actually like do your own like D&D adventures with your, you know, the background sets and the characters too with that idea diorama.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was pretty unique, at least from what I've seen of all the Kickstarters I've backed with the diorama. Like, what?
Oh, cool.
Because it works so well with your 2D art style.
Yeah, I mean, the game feels flat as it is anyway, so we're not compromising or sort of rendering out what used to be a really nice 3D model, on a piece of card. The guys already look like they live in a world made of cards, so
kind of
works.
Kind of reminds me of a card hunter, so keeping that up, though. But when you decide on an engine, like you said, are you guys creating your own engine? Sounds like that you were actually doing that.
Yeah, we were. We started back in May of last year, so about a year ago, and Unity didn't have its 2D package out yet, so that wasn't, an option. But we also kind of felt like we want very specific things, and we always wanted this kind of flat kind of look to it, and wanted that board game feel, and we just felt like, with intelligent use of libraries and that kind of thing, we could build something that did what we needed without, being overly complex, so...
Right.
And it's been a challenge and a good thing. Yeah, it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, definitely a mixed bag, because you ever heard of the game called Jonestown?
Yeah.
Jamestown, sorry. Mm-hmm. There are developers around here in the Philly of Final Form Games, and even though they made their own engine because they had, they wanted to make sure everything's 60 frames per second and everything, they lost a good chunk of their entire budget just in creating the engine, and they spent, many years going back and fixing it and doing all these reworks and getting to work with Linux, and that's always pretty ballsy for a developer to say they're going to make their own engine. So congrats on you.
Yeah, it's well, we're not making a full featured engine that could run any game. We're making an engine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So hopefully that has kind of helped to mitigate maybe some of those risks.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I would say, what references and stuff did you use when creating it? Because you said that you said that you went for the style because it was easier to create assets, or?
Well, that was part of it. But I mean, creatively, we wanted, I wanted strong, hard edges because the gameplay is, meant to be sort of hard and uncompromising. We wanted, a lot of black because, darkness is a key mechanic in the game. The darker it gets, the harder it gets. So we wanted everything to look like it was kind of emerging, out of the dark or threatening to get swallowed by it. And I wanted something that was punchy and unique. And so if you saw just even the smallest little screenshot of the game, you would know which game it was from. And I kind of pulled, a lot of comic book references, guys that I grew up admiring, like Mike Mignola and Guy Davis and Victor Kalvachev, and guys who are really great with the heavy inks. So it was awesome to be able to kind of revisit those influences kind of from my past, because I've been doing so much digital painting for so many years as a concept artist. That just seems to be what the industry wants right now. So it's been really awesome to just, shake all that off and just concentrate on different, art priorities, value and shape and that kind of thing over rendering.
That was definitely my first impression. That was a comic book or it got inspired from comics, at least in the lining. And, I also liked, I don't know why, but the Plague Doctor stands out so much to me in the character design. I think it's that mask has so much interesting history, which is why I love you chose it for the design.
Oh, cool. Thanks. Yeah, that's another example of one of those classes. It's historically accurate. Those things existed. And I feel in particular, the classes like that really help kind of ground our game in sort of a low fantasy setting as opposed to the sort of aspirational high fantasy.
Random nitpick, though. Did pistols exist at the same time as the Plague Doctors?
Maybe not, but random rebuttal. the time span for a game is really nebulous. The whole vibe of the game is kind of a little bit Twilight Zone-y. So we kind of span probably about 300 years. I guess from an IP standpoint, I look at it as what if the Middle Ages lasted, 300 years longer than it should have?
Okay.
So we're pushing into flintlocks, we're pushing into the 1650s, but everyone is still under sort of superstitious and religious oppression, and things are still kind of mucky and gross and dirty. But the whole game kind of happens outside of time, and it doesn't happen on Earth, it doesn't happen anywhere, it just happens, on your family estate, and that place is its own kind of, it has its own set of rules.
It fits so well too, because I said UGG earlier about the Middle Ages lasting longer than it did, because there's just so much, people were so superstitious. They burned people for the smallest things and fractions. And so it fits very well with that whole paranoia system that you've set up.
Yeah, I think so too. And it also like kind of plays into that. Like we have occultism and we have sort of like prayer and holy stuff, but we don't have like elemental magic and that kind of thing, because that stuff was always the stuff of fantasy, you know, whereas people believed that their superstitions were real back then. So mm-hmm. they believed in devils and demons and possession, and that stuff was like, no, that's legit. Like, you know, Josh couldn't come out on Thursday. He was possessed. Like, okay, cool. Is he better now? That stuff was taken at face value. So that's the kind of magic, you know, in our world. Is that really... Okay.
All right. So that was great. So for our final section, then, we're going to talk a little bit about the gameplay of The Darkest Dungeon. We're not going to get too far into it tonight because, one, Chris has got to go in a few minutes, and two, it is getting pretty late. It's after midnight for us. Chris, I think it's like a little bit after 9 o'clock for you. So
yeah.
So what we'll do then is we'll save the bulk of our questions for probably a part two for the podcast. So, Chris, I guess in terms of general questions and about The Darkest Dungeon, we've been talking bits and pieces about the design and the gameplay over the cast, but for the people who have completely missed it, general experience of The Darkest Dungeon, like?
Well, I guess the core loop mm-hmm. is sort of what you're asking about,
yeah.
and that involves looking at your estate, the town, deciding your roster loadout, which character classes and which instances of those characters that you want to bring with you.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are going to be laid up in the bar. Some people are going to be, you know, trying to burn their stress off in the church. So you have to pick from who's available. Then you sort of move forward. You plan your next move by looking at kind of an estate map. You select any number of different, like one of any number of different quests
mm-hmm.
Based on, you know, they each have a different difficulty because you might be trying to run some new characters through, or you might be looking to sort of make mm-hmm. some progression with your vets. Once you select your quest, you'll provision them.
Mm-hmm.
And economics is actually a big part of the game. If you spend a whole bunch of money on preparation and, you know, food and firewood and that kind of thing, you won't have very much room in your inventory to carry loot out, and so you might end up costing more than the expedition was actually worth.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to be really careful. And also, the type of dungeon that you're going to is going to have different considerations. So, for instance, you might need more anti-venom if you head into the sort of toxic warrens than you would if you go into the ruins.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll be making those types of decisions as you kind of spend money and kit out your guys. And then you'll embark on the expedition. You'll go straight to the dungeon. The dungeon runs are about 20, 30 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
There's a variety of different objectives. The dungeons are procedurally generated, so there's no way to sort of cheat the system and map mm-hmm. them out before you go.
Okay.
And then after sort of successfully completing your objective, you'll be taken to sort of a results screen. Your loot and stuff get automatically sold off to gold,
mm-hmm.
and then you'll be taken back to town where you can sort of choose what to spend that money on. Do you recruit new characters? Do you upgrade characters that you have? Do you get them better weapons and armor?
Mm-hmm.
Do you upgrade your buildings in town to sort of get access to higher tier weaponry? Do you upgrade characters' different skills? There's a whole slew of things you can do with your money.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most important of which is placing sort of traumatized heroes in a variety of different town activities, things like, you know, drinking at the bar, gambling, meditating in the abbey, flagellation. Mm-hmm. You might need to send them to the sanitarium to burn off like a negative quark that they might have acquired.
And that's always a fun time, right? Hanging out in the sanitarium.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's also like, you know, unknown hidden side effects that can happen. So if you keep sending a guy to the bar, after a while, you're going to have to send him to a bar because he needs to drink.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing is ever perfect. And really, the philosophy of the game is that we're challenging players to think like managers and make the best of an imperfect situation as opposed to trying to craft a perfect one.
Mm-hmm.
So even your best guy is going to have quirks on him that you're not really that fond of.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the beauty of it because, you know, so do people.
And I don't know if we mentioned this on the cast yet, but in The Darkest Dungeon, you don't play as a hero, you sort of play as, you said, like the manager or the guy who's overseeing these heroes that you create and cultivate over the course of the game.
Yeah, it's like XCOM in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you as the player have sort of inherited this spoiled estate land, and it falls to you to kind of clean it up. So you recruit mercs and heroes and outlaws and men and women, and you sort of send them off on these tasks to sort of bring order back to your sort of family homestead. But mm-hmm. you don't have a direct avatar in the game. You're kind of the mm-hmm. overmind, I guess. Although you control them directly in combat and that kind of thing.
Okay. Are the quests that you mentioned, are they randomly generated, or do you have basically like a list of quests that can appear when you basically try to go find a quest, essentially.
There's like a huge pool of quests, and they're almost like loot in a sense. So you'll go to the estate map, and you'll be like, "Oh, awesome! Like a, you know, like a double black diamond quest just opened up. Sweet, I'm gonna grab that one because next time I come back to the map, it might be gone." Mm-hmm. So in that sense, the estate is kind of like a living world where you know, every time you sort of revisit the map and sort of see what needs doing, it's gonna be something different. And some are, you know, gonna be much more hazardous with higher rewards, and others might be, you know, a little bit more easy, you know, to make sure that you always have an option for your lower level guys. The game has no set global difficulty level. You decide what difficulty quest you're up for, and we did that because even seasoned players are going to want to be leveling up new recruits, right? So you need to have access to easier and more difficult content, you know, no matter where you are at in the game.
Are the character classes themselves all available from the start, or do you have to unlock few through play?
You unlock several of them through play. I mean, then we cover off the major rules when you know with the ones that are immediately available, so you're not going to be at a disadvantage. But as you explore and upgrade buildings, like your stagecoach is how you kind of recruit new heroes. So as you upgrade your stagecoach, you get access to different character classes. Some of them require other means of unlocking. So it's definitely a mark of progression.
Okay. I know, as you said, you can basically recruit different characters of the same class. When you recruit a character, does every character class essentially have a set list of base stats, or is it like this crusader may start with a little higher health than this one, but this one may have a little stronger damage than this one, or is it all just set stats for each class?
Well, yeah, you can actually run a party of all crusaders if you want to. So we don't put any limits on you in that regard. When it comes to recruiting, they come preloaded with a couple of quirks already. So that kind of speaks to, you know, oh, this crusader actually has like higher melee damage. I definitely want to hire this guy. You know, this crusader's got a lazy eye, and so his accuracy is a little bit lower. Maybe give him a pass. Or if you really need a crusader, you take him anyway and hope the best and try and get rid of that quirk through gameplay. So you have a lot of options, and each instance of the character, though, is their own discrete entity. So if you upgrade, you know, Crusader A's skills but not Crusader B, then Crusader A, you know, he has his own name. He has those skills unlocked. The other Crusader doesn't.
Cool. And one last question, or one last general question for me then. As we talk about with this sort of like the grim and foreboding nature of the Darkest Dungeon, when a character dies in the dungeon, are they dead for good? Like, are we dealing with like Iron Man rules with the Darkest Dungeon?
I mean, we're dealing with Iron Man rules for the whole game. So, yeah, when you lose a guy, he's gone, she's gone. That's it. There's, you know, we've got an extremely rare, maybe you find one or two of them in your entire play session, currency that'll allow you to bring a guy back. But it's like Gandalf style. So, like, you'll get him back, but they're not quite the same.
Nice.
You know, it's like, hey, I think, you know, I remember you, but... So, but you know, 98% of the time, when you lose a guy, that's it, man.
All right. And the game, as you said, because you can generally recruit new people, is it hard to basically get into an unwinnable state, like a point where you don't have enough money to field new guys, you can't do anything, and you just have to start over?
No, we don't back you in a corner like that. Okay. You never will need to start over. You'll always be able to get the core group of heroes recruited for free or in a way that, you know, doesn't tax you if you're out of money. You can always make progress. So even if you have party wipe after party wipe after party wipe, you're still able to play the game because there is no real start over. It's the game is designed to be played, not really to be kind of started, middled, and ended. Although there is an end, know, it'll roll over into a new game plus. So
awesome.
It's yeah, we don't sort of cloister you in where you need to do like a hard reset.
All right. So I guess, Chris, you have to probably get going in a few minutes.
Yeah, I've got a little 1 week old that needs some attention.
All right, not a problem. So I think with that, we're going to wrap things up. Chris, I got pretty much like a boatload more questions about the Darkest Dungeon in terms of game design, but we can definitely save that for another time. Hopefully we can get you and maybe Tyler on the cast and we can have some fun.
Yeah, sounds great. Definitely, let's just keep emailing back and forth and figure out another time to do a follow up. I'm sorry to have to jet out of here.
Yeah, not a problem. And as we were saying, it is getting pretty late, and we've done these late casts before, and generally around this time is when we start to slur our speech and get into a whole lot of blooper reels, basically.
We asked a lot of bad questions.
Yeah.
No worries.
All right. So with that, Chris, it was a pleasure talking tonight. And as we just said, hopefully we can talk again very soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for the opportunity to talk about the game. I love it, so it's great to talk about.
Yep, and I'm definitely interested as well. And Ken, it was great having you on and joining me for this late night cast.
No problem.
All right. So with that said, we're going to wrap things up for the podcast this week. As always, if you're interested in contributing to Game Wisdom, you can check us out on our submissions wanted page. You can find the link to that on the front page. That'll be for emailing either about being a future podcast guest or by writing a guest piece for the site. And as always, we do have our Patreon crowdfunding campaign up to hopefully improve the site and get some better equipment for live casting. You can find all the information under the donate link on the front page. So with that said, have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.